Ice cream man. Can I? Not my luck. Okay, that's close enough before another ice cream man comes. So welcome to today's talk. This is Monday, I think. Oh dear. You know, when you do a lot of meditation, you live in the present moment, and sometimes you're not really quite sure what day it is, because at work you know it's Monday or Wednesday or Friday. If you live out there in the world, the weekend is different than the weekdays. If you live in a monastery or you live in a retreat centre, and sometimes you forget what day is which. But that was a big problem for me, because it was true over in the monasteries in Thailand, it didn't really matter what day of the week it was. So you totally forgot, you know, it was Monday or Wednesday, or whether it was, I know it's fly day today, because that fly is buzzing around me. But you do know that it's roughly about what the month is. But it came to the time that, and this is no exaggeration, I didn't even know what year it was, it didn't really matter. And so you do go into a timeless space, but it's important to actually have some idea what the day is, because the first weeks I was in Perth, this was still staying in the Magnolia Street Temple, that fly, this is not fly day, okay, it's Monday, so off you go. Come back again on Friday, okay? So, where were we? At the temple, there was one poor fellow had an epileptic fit. And so I was there, so we decided to call an ambulance, make sure he was okay. And then after he had his fit, the ambulance drivers came, and the first thing they asked him was, what day of the week is it? And he didn't know, he just had a fit, and so straight in the ambulance. I said, why do you ask him that? So that's standard procedure. You know, we ask a person what day it is, and if they don't know, you go straight in the ambulance. So I'm glad you never asked me, because I would have got in the ambulance as well. So sometimes it's nice to know roughly. So it's Monday today, okay? So if the ambulance comes, it's Monday. But anyway, third day of the retreat, it's now sort of time to start getting a bit deeper into the meditation teachings. The first few days, again, we're just relaxing, getting settled into the place, and just improving our awareness, getting to know just roughly our body and how much sleep it needs, how much food it needs, how much to exercise it, and little by little we get into just the physical part of this retreat centre. And then afterwards you can actually use exactly the same sort of methods of being aware, being kind, working with what you have, to actually go deeper into the mind and get to some of these amazing meditation states. And so far I have mentioned that how to relax to the max, the importance of remembering the second fact of the Eightfold Path, the right motivation, the Sammasankappa, and the three right motivations, Nekama Sankappa, Avayapadaka Sankappa, and Ahimsaka Sankappa. And the first one is like Nekama, renouncing, letting go, giving up, and not so fighting things, making peace with them. And then Avayapada, which is the same as Metta, it's no ill will, it's loving kindness. And the last one, Ahimsaka, which is non-violence, gentleness. They're all making peace, being kind, being gentle, or rather letting go. Being kind, being gentle. So that kindness and that gentleness is right there in the beginning, and I have emphasized that, you know, in one's practice. The letting go is what overcomes the first hindrance of, you know, wanting something. The metta overcomes the second hindrance of ill will, trying to get rid of things. So those are two important things which have to be dealt with. And once you do that, the mindfulness can get strong. And of course, yesterday I was focusing on the Emperor's three questions. Now's the most important time. The thing in front of you is the most important thing in the world. And that's emphasizing the mindfulness, actually being here. Not trying to go somewhere else and thinking that when I get to the next stage of meditation, it'll be better. Oh, I remember the time, the last retreat I went, and it was such a wonderful meditation. Of course, that's lingering in the past. That'll never get you anywhere. And so in this moment, giving attention to what we're experiencing right now and being kind. And to emphasize that even more, now I'm going to relate one of the stories, the similes, which I've adapted over those years, and it's a very useful simile. Of course, no simile is perfect, but every simile has its strengths, and this one has got a lot of strength in that it gives a visual understanding of what meditation is and how it works. And that's a simile of the thousand-petal lotus. A lotus, we've got one over there, but that's only a plastic one. A lotus closes up at night time. And only when the first rays of the sun hit the lotus, only then does the lotus begin to open up. And if you see that lotus early in the morning or even at night time, and you examine that lotus does not look like it's got anything much inside of it. The outermost sheath of the lotus is protecting those delicate petals inside. And the outermost sheath is usually corrugated. It's tough, leathery, dusty, because that has to withstand the wind and the storms of the world to protect what's inside. And as soon as the first rays of the sun, the warmth and light of the sun, hit that outermost sheath of the lotus, it opens up slowly to reveal the next layer of petals hidden inside. And that allows that layer of petals to receive the warmth and the light of the sun. So that first real layer of petals, not the sheath, that can now open up to reveal the next layer of petals. Layer after layer after layer opens up to reveal the one inside of it, so that can receive warmth and light of the sun and open up in turn. That's the way a lotus opens. And you've probably all had enough experience that the more you go deep into the lotus, the more beautiful it looks. The petals, the colors, the fragrance becomes more intense, and the colors more gorgeous. And even, but the petals get more and more thin, more and more profound and subtle as you go deeper and deeper into the lotus. And of course, you know what that simile represents. You are that lotus. And you are that lotus when you're all closed up, just like that gentleman who I thought belonged in Carnet Prison Farm with all the tattoos and very rough on the outside. That's what I just judged him, just by his rough exterior. But didn't realize just how much beauty was right inside of him. And of course, he managed to open it up and see it. And this is the first wonderful meaning of this simile. You are that lotus. Every human being is like that lotus. And inside of you, you've got the most incredible, beautiful petals. And you'll experience that sooner or later. Every one of you, if you can open up enough, they're the jhanas that bliss you out. All the stages of enlightenment right inside of you. Now what do you need to do? You need to somehow find out how to open those petals. And how do you open the petals to find out what's inside? The warmth and light of the sun. It's not just the light of the sun, it's its warmth as well. The light of the sun is a good metaphor, simile for awareness, mindfulness. You're shining the light of mindfulness onto that layer of petals. You're right here, right now, which is important. You can't say it's mindfulness when you're off into the future, thinking what you're going to do next, or you're dwelling in the past. Mindfulness is now. And it's also, it is quiet. And giving this moment full attention right now. Obviously, you know, because of my past lives, I had very good mindfulness. I recall even at school, I had a very easy time at school, because even when the teachers were giving a lesson, I was able just to be quiet and listen to it. I wasn't thinking, I wasn't arguing. My mind was just so peaceful and silent, not thinking, that when the teacher gave a lesson, I remembered it. And it was just a very simple trick of memory. If when somebody is teaching or saying something, if you are thinking about something else or trying to take notes or trying to remember something, you're distracted. But when you just sit there with a clear mind, full attention, wow, you remember so much. And that's, I remember as a kid doing that, and sometimes a teacher would ask a question and I would give the answer. I wouldn't just know the answer, I remember when the teacher said that. And if you look at mindfulness, the way the Buddha described it, he made that connection between mindfulness and a good memory. Simply because, so you're like a simile of being a dry sponge. A dry sponge soaks up everything. But if you're wet or damp, you can't actually soak up so much. So if your mind is thinking or busy, then of course it doesn't sort of receive so much information of what's happening in the world. So when you're really mindful, paying full attention to what's happening, not trying to, you know, split your mind up with trying to remember it and also trying to listen to it and trying to figure out what it means, but just listening with a very clear mind, of course, you actually retain a lot of that information. So, we're fully mindful of this moment, of this old lotus, all closed up. And we're kind to it. The warmth of the sun stands for the kindness. So that's why the light and the warmth is a beautiful simile for mindfulness and kindness working together. And I don't know, in meditation, without the kindness, I can't see how anyone can get into deep meditation. Yeah, they can force their mind, they can look on the outwards to be really still. But that type of stillness, that concentrated, enforced stillness, is the same sort of immobility which you will see with those horse guards in those little, what you might call it, little booths outside Buckingham Palace, standing there while all the Japanese tourists take their photograph or try and distract them, and they stand there immobile, not showing any emotions, like toy soldiers outside of Buckingham Palace. Have you seen those? How can they do that? For 1 hour, sit there when everyone's trying to distract them? They can do, could you do that here? If you're sitting in meditation and somebody came up to take your photograph or tap you or say, hey, what are you up to? But they can do that, but that's through force. So they can only do it for half an hour. And I'm sure that none of those soldiers is enlightened or got jhanas, that's for sure. But nevertheless, they can do that. They can hold the body still, but that is not how you're going to really be able to maintain that for long periods of time. So instead, we are mindful, we're kind, not using force, which is basically made of ill will. I don't want to be here. This is where I want to be. And so we use kindness. It's wonderful opening the door of your heart to this moment, valuing, appreciating, and giving this beautiful joy and happiness to this moment. So if you can do that, then you start to know how to open up a lotus. Which brings me on to a little segue. Those of you who haven't been here before would wonder, what's up with all the teddy bears everywhere? Is this a meditation retreat or a playgroup for juveniles? What are these doing here? And the story behind the teddy bears, many years ago, when I was teaching a retreat in Hong Kong, there in Hong Kong, one of the meditators, without being asked, not telling me, brought his two teddy bears to the retreat. And they were at no extra charge. Teddy bears are easy to maintain. They don't make any noise. They don't have a cup of coffee at 2 o'clock in the morning. But he brought his two teddy bears, and they were so cute. I put them on the shrine next to the Buddha, like Sariputra and Moggallana, the two teddy bears. And then I suggested anyone wanted to borrow the teddy bears, they could. Just for the day. So they could, as I'm doing now, put them on the lap and meditate with the teddy bear on the lap. And those teddy bears, they disappeared. Every day there was a waiting list of people wanted to borrow them. And at the end of the retreat, you know, some of the more wealthy Hong Kongers there, they sort of started to offer huge amounts of money. Can I have that, please, teddy bear? Of course, you know, he refused to sell them. He took them home with him. He was very attached to them. But there was something which was missing in many people's meditation. That softness, the sense of safety, kindness. And if you cuddle a little teddy bear, you find that it does bring up huge amounts of softness, kindness. It actually allows you to start developing the real loving kindness. Because a teddy bear is not threatening. You threatening? No. Okay. If it's like a cat or a dog, oh, sometimes cats and dogs can be okay, but sometimes they jump out of your lap. Sometimes they just want to lick you and you've already actually just bathed already, if it's a dog. If it's a little baby, they poop. It's true. You know, so, sometimes the sort of things monks and nuns have to do is just weird. In the Thai tradition, one of the things which monks have to do is to give the first haircut to kids. So sometimes you've got this, actually I think next Saturday somebody's coming to get their kid. I don't know why it is they want monks to do their haircut. Shaving, yeah, I can do that for the little kid, but they don't want me to do that, just a little cut of the few locks of the hair. But anyway, so you have to take the kid and quickly cut before it screams. And hopefully it doesn't poop on your robe. Even it's got nappies on, but still, you know, after you give it back again, the smell is still there. So that's the sort of thing which monks have to do. I don't know why, but a little teddy bear never poops. Just sits there nice and kind, and I could actually give it compassion and get compassion back. It's a very good compassion bear. And, of course, the proof of this is in the trying it. And if you try to meditate and then you try with a teddy bear one day, you find it actually does work. People can generate much more kindness, softness, safety as well, with a bear on your lap, rather than anything else. So we use that as a means. And of course, those of you who have followed me and got some of my books, you know that's one of the books which was written. It's called Bear Awareness. Not B-A-R-E, which is the usual meaning of the term bear awareness, means just being aware and nothing else, but bear awareness, B-E-A-R, awareness. In other words, awareness together with kindness. And that's actually just, oh, we had one or two bears here, but they've grown. Look at them. Just every time I come here, there's more bears appear somewhere. And so, and I don't tell people to go and borrow them. They just borrow them. And maybe it's because, you know, when the retreat ends, I'm not sure what the bears get up to, but there's always more bears the next day. I don't think they're keeping their 8 precepts. You can see a baby bear over there. That must be just freshly born. Look at it, it's a tiny little thing. But it does give a sense of like softness and kindness. And so that's one of the ways we can develop the kindness when we're meditating. So we're sitting here and we're developing awareness and kindness onto this moment. Well, first of all, onto your body. So if it's onto your own body, first of all, that's the outermost petal of the lotus, this body of yours. And sometimes when people are young, you don't have too many aches and pains. But as you go older, it gets more rusty, more joints start to creak, more things start to go wrong. As I've often taught people, that as you get older, you need glasses, you can't see very well. As you get older, you can't always hear what's going on. As you get older, your arms start to lose their strength and even tremble with Parkinson's disease. And as you get older, even your legs sort of get weaker. But there is one part of your body which gets stronger and stronger and stronger with every year. And you all know what that is. You look at old people. The one part which does not get weaker is their mouth. Old people can talk and talk and talk and talk and talk and talk and talk. They can't hear very much, but they can talk. That's why I know that I'm going to have a job until I die, because my mouth will never get weak. So, yeah, so people get a bit old and achy and painy. But that's what even the Buddha said when he was very old. He said the only time he can get some peace from his achy body is in deep meditation. You go beyond the body, you go inside it. You don't go outside of things, you go deep inside where you already are. So that's you. You're watching this body, first of all, being aware of it, giving it full attention. It's right in front of me now. It's the most important thing in the world for me. In this moment, I'm going to care for it. And I know when I care for my body, it relaxes. If I don't care for it, I tense up. You get afraid. And I know that, actually, I first read this in those, for those people who remember, it was a cult author, Edgar Allan Poe. He wrote all these like short horror novels. And they were made into movies when I was young. But one of those things we had, he had The Pit and the Pendulum. We had, you know, this is in Spanish Inquisition, where they put this fellow on a piece of wood, and the pendulum would swing above his chest. And every time it swung, it got a 5 millimeters lower. Swing, swing, closer and closer to his body. And that was, you know, he's a really weird fellow. These days, that fellow would be a really strong case for psychotherapy. I don't know what he did, but one of the other ones which he did was the Mask of the Red Death. And the mask was so they have these masks where people dress up in costumes. But anyway, that this was based on the plagues which used to go through Europe and decimating whole populations. And in this passage, which I thought was so much insight into the nature of disasters and plagues, that they had the different demons. The demons were the ones who were supposed to be spreading those plagues in the theology of those days. And so the demons met in a forest somewhere in France, and they started comparing notes. Yeah, I've just come from London. I sort of killed, maybe 10,000 people there. Oh, I've just come from Berlin. I killed 15,000. I've just come from Rome. I killed 20,000. I just come from Paris. I only killed 5,000. But fear killed 100,000. And when I heard that, I thought, wow. The disease kills a small amount of people. But how many people get killed by fear? And I thought that fellow was onto something there. That it's fear is what creates just a tightness in the body. Fear is what creates just the imbalance in the guts. Fear creates so many diseases and infirmities. But it's so hard to overcome that fear. But how do you overcome fear? Kindness, reassurance. No fear, Ajahn Brahm is here. Well, the teddy bear's here. That relaxes you. That's one of the reasons, even insomnia. You can't go to sleep at night. I don't know if anyone started to experience that on a meditation retreat, but people, you know, if they put this on the question box or they come up on interviews, Ajahn Brahm, I just have a lot of trouble sleeping at night. And then, you know, I know who you are, and then I sort of say, well, you don't have any trouble sleeping during the meditation. Why is it you can't sleep at night? So the answer's obvious. When you come to do the meditation, try to go to sleep. Then you'll be fully awake. And when you go to bed at night, try to meditate. You fall asleep. Now, that's not just a joke. Why is it that when you go to sleep at night, you can't go to sleep because you're trying to go to sleep? That trying is tension. And then comes the fear. I want to get up in the morning. I want to get up early in the morning. If I don't go to sleep now, I won't be able to get up. I would just, you know, miss breakfast. I would miss the chanting. I really want to try and do the chanting. The morning is just a great time to meditate. Ajahn Brahm said, this is actually true. It's amazing. How many people get enlightened in the morning at dawn? So if you never actually wake up for the dawn, you're lessening your chances of getting enlightened. So, and people say, oh, I've got to get up in the morning. And of course, that fear keeps you awake. Or you hear something outside your room. Bump. There's no coffins here. And there's also... But it's amazing how many people, you know, when they hear and they swear to me, it was footsteps, human footsteps, outside your room. You know what it is? Kangaroos. Yeah, exactly, it's kangaroos. Because kangaroos at night, you know, they don't actually hop, they just drag their feet forward and their back feet forward. And it actually sounds like human beings are walking. So if you feel like there's someone walking outside your room at night, it just happens so often. Nobody would be walking outside your room at night time. They'd be just too tired. They're all asleep. They're not going to give up their beauty sleep to walk outside your room. But the kangaroos, they're the ones who make all that noise. So it's just kangaroos, so don't worry. But it's the fear will keep you awake. The fear does all sorts of terrible things to you, which is one of the reasons, a little bit of reassurance. Even as when I was a school teacher for 1 year, and when we were doing our preliminary training to go to school and teach kids, especially in science, you know, one of my fellow students, they made a very good comment. Look, we've been working in laboratories and labs at school. We know sometimes some children are either naughty or they're pushing boundaries. And so, you know, there's concentrated acid on the shelf. Now, what do we do? You know, if some kid, just when you're looking the other direction, just knocks over the jar of acid and it falls on somebody. And you've got responsibility to look after that kid. What happens if they put these metal protractors into electricity sockets and burn themselves? You know, you do need basic first aid training in a school. I remember when, you know, one of the, I don't mind any anecdotes, I hope so anyway, when I was teaching in the high school in a chemistry class, it was all about sort of, you know, oxidization. And so for one of the little experiments, we got some sodium, you know, pure sodium, you know, to put it in water just to see just how it reacted. And there was even flames and stuff. And so it was all prepared. I had a lab assistant there, and I told him before, you know, because they're all big pieces. The other teachers already got the small pieces of sodium, the safe ones. There's only the big ones left. So I asked the lab assistants, well, just get some of this other liquid which is non-reactive to the sodium so I can cut up into small pieces. But the lab assistant made a mistake, and it wasn't sort of this inert solution in which I could cut the sodium pieces. It was water. So I put this huge piece into this beaker of, I thought was inert liquid, but it was water. And flames came up. And oh, the kids in the class, they loved that experiment. Can you do it again, sir? And me, I was terrified that I was going to burn the school down. And they remember that at the end of the year. Said, oh, that was just the highlight of the year. Seeing you, just, and I said, that was really dangerous. I was very lucky to actually to survive that one. But anyway, so it's fear. If I was fortunate, I could contain my fear and just relax and not give that fear to other kids as well, so people can relax, which meant there was no harm done. But even in your body, fear creates a lot of pain, tension, tightness. And at that school, that's right, that's when the GP gave some excellent advice. He said, you know, if a kid, you know, looks like his leg is hanging off, or, you know, there's blood everywhere, he said, the last thing to do is to be afraid as a school teacher. He said, that's one time it's good to lie. That's what he said. If you look at him, you just say, oh, that's nothing, you'll be fine. Because you say, oh, that looks terrible. Whoa. Wow, that's disgusting. What does that do to the poor kid who's just poured acid on him? That just makes it worse. And I don't know, I remember just going on arms round in Thailand with bare feet and just trod on a nail, it went right through. And the monk with me, I didn't hurt at all. I just, oh, that's interesting to see the other part of the nail just poking through the top of your foot. We're talking about, that's, you know, par for the course for holy people, that Jesus had to get up and not go there. But it didn't hurt at all at first, and I just look at this. The monk with me said, oh, that's terrible, just like you did. And as soon as they said that, it started to hurt. So I wish they hadn't said that. He said, oh, that's nothing. So that's one of the reasons. Why does that happen? Because the fear makes the pain much worse. It's the fear that makes you more in your body. And so if we can let go of some of that fear and just be kind, then a lot of that pain vanishes. And I'm sure that you've had those experiences, especially with my mum. Whenever I would hurt myself, she'd just come and just give you a hug or stroke your hair if you had a fever in bed. Or, you know, when I'm playing soccer all the time and just went for a tackle on the floor, and my mum would just lean down and kiss the open wound with all those bugs in her mouth. We didn't have great oral hygiene in those days. And Arun never got infected, never once. But even more than that, as soon as she knelt down and kissed the wound, the pain went immediately. It's much better than morphine. Mumphine. And if you've experienced that, a bit of kindness just takes the aches and pains away. Just that wonderful sense of just the body opens up. It doesn't scrunch up out of fear. It opens up and allows healing stuff to happen. Oh, on that, I should also say that sometimes in the meditation, it's on a tangent again, but it's an important tangent. I want to mention this because sometimes in your meditation, weird things happen in your body. And sometimes, you know, like this woman once in a retreat years and years ago, her body twisted around. I mean, really twisted, contorted. You know, you can usually see that I'm trying to sort of demonstrate it, but look, I can't do that. If I did, you'll have to take me to the hospital because she was absolutely contorted. And I thought, this is, there was another meditator, you know, taught me other meditation, said, look at this, you know, she's in trouble. And she did really look just so uncomfortable. So I waited for her until she came out of meditation, took her aside and said, how are you feeling? And she said, wonderful. And I realized again, just, you know, sometimes how you can misinterpret these things. And I understood. I said, because during the meditation, you were just so contorted and bent, you know, really just in a way that I cannot demonstrate, like this, only about 10 times more. I said, was I? I said, yeah, that's how you were sitting. But when did you have your car accident? And that's when she looked at me and said, Ajahn, I always thought you had psychic powers. I never told you. You knew about that. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Confirmation at last. Ajahn Brahm has psychic powers. I said, no, unfortunately. It's just, you know, the experience, understanding what meditation is and how it works. And he said, because what had happened, you'd let go of your body. You know, to a sense, you're really peaceful. You weren't worried about the body. You weren't trying to control it. You were inside somewhere. And your body had bent itself to the position it needed to unblock sort of channels of energy so they could go to where it was needed to heal your body. You couldn't do that consciously. You had to just disappear into deep meditation and then the body had a chance. She's out of the way, she's not here now. Now I can actually heal myself. And she's contorted. And had so many cases like that over these years. Weird stuff happening in the body. Energy flows going actually through the body. Or just hot spots. Hot spots are just really common. You're meditating and your shoulders get really warm. And it's like a localized fever, but it's not unpleasant. And then afterwards you feel, oh, so good. Because that's usually healing whiplash. And other hot spots in the body. That means it's... The body knows that there's a problem there and sends all the energy there when you're not trying to control it or worrying about what the heck's going on. So any of those weird stuff in your body when you're meditating, if you're peaceful, great, that's doing a huge amount of healing. So feel good about that. Oh yes, I was just zapped to breast cancer. I just zapped colon cancer or whatever it is, because you feel just a huge amount of warmth coming in. It feels really good, and afterwards, wow, you feel great. So anyway, that's an interesting thing which happens during the meditation. But anyway, going back to why do I keep going on these tangents? Because they're important, that's why. And going back to the thousand petal lotus. So you look after your body. You're kind to it. Things relax, heal. The body feels so good. And when it feels so good, peaceful, when it's not a problem, then you can put it down. You don't have to worry about it. So you can go inside. And inside is, that's where your emotional world, your mind lives. So it's not as if you go on to the next stage. In this meditation, always into the next stage. Body opens up. And you get all these different layers of your mind. And one of those first ones is, of course, time. We're always worried about future and past. And it's hard to let go of those, because that's what runs our life. You have your schedules, where you have to be, and where you came from. You know, that's sometimes such a burden when we imprison ourselves by our failures of the past. Because you couldn't get meditation last time, and you think, no, it's not going to happen. Or you're not good enough because somebody told you that, and it's, what do they know, are you good enough or not good enough? Or you're afraid of the future. There's only 7 days left. And I haven't got anything yet. I haven't even done much meditation. Time is slipping away so fast. I don't know when I can ever come on one of these retreats again. It's so difficult. It's only 7 days. And while you're worrying, that's another day gone. Only 6 days left. And sometimes you can see you're in a prison of that future. It doesn't let you be free. Which is one of the reasons why that we let go of the prisons of the past and the future, so we can actually be here. And kindness allows you to be here. You're kind to yourself, give yourself a break. Allow yourself just to be. And for those of you who want to practice that, one of the best ways of meditation is just having a cup of tea, sitting out in front of the dining room, on the chairs and just watching the trees grow, watching the birds flip through the trees, just watching people come up and go down again. You're just sitting there peacefully having a cup of tea or coffee or just an empty cup. The cup is just an excuse to be there. And you're just sitting there. And because you're not doing anything, because you're not trying to attain anything, because you are what some people say, killing time. What a beautiful thing that is, to kill this enemy called time. But don't just kill it, stomp it, destroy it, terminate it, so time never arises again to dominate your life. What a wonderful thing is if we can kill time properly, instead of allowing it to reincarnate next moment. Oh, I've got to be somewhere. I've got to be somewhere. I've got to be this. No, what a wonderful thing it is to destroy your conception of time by sitting there doing nothing, just watching the trees grow. That was my excuse. Because sometimes, you know what life is like? You'll be enjoying yourself just sitting down there, and somebody will ask you, are you doing anything? I said, no. Oh, great, come and give me a hand. And so they don't respect the importance of doing nothing. It's a vital job in life. So because of that, you know, if I'm sitting down just on a chair somewhere, if I'm not having a cup of tea, or, you know, the tea's, you know, I'll be drunk half an hour ago. So what are you doing? I'm watching the trees grow. That was my excuse, watching trees grow. I spent a lot of time watching trees grow. They do grow. You know that. Have you ever seen a tree grow?
No.
Well, you're not looking long enough. Just go out there and just watch and wait, because as soon as you do something, that's when it grows. You've got to pay full attention. It's a good excuse for doing nothing. For just being there. So that is how we can actually become free from the prisons of time. So we've got this layer of petals called time, past and future. And we go in. What's right in the center of the past and future? Now. And also about the whole idea of like nothing is higher than any divinity. Not just nothing. Where do you want to go anyway? Nowhere. What does the word nowhere really mean? It's made up of two words. Now and here. So if you're now and here, you're nowhere. Now, come on, N-O-W-H-E-R-E spells nowhere. So it's great, you're getting nowhere, you're just here, in the now. That's nowhere. So, when you actually come into the present moment, into nowhere, then just really come into the present moment. And first of all, you think you're in the present moment, but you're not truly there. If you really are in the present moment, you can't say anything. You can't even think. There's no time to think. All comments are descriptions of something which happened a moment or two ago, or trying to figure out where it's going to lead to somewhere in the future. If you're really right in the center of the now, right in its very middle, what's in the center of now? N-O-W, zero, nothing, is right in the center of now. And that's just the zero. What happens when you go into the middle of the zero? It's empty. Inside the perfect circle, N-O-W, the O in the middle of now, there's nothing there. So there, we go into silence. So you're just going in to the mind, in to the beyond time, into the present moment, beyond thought, just here, into the silent present moment. But in the silent present moment, as I mentioned, what happens next? You're aware of the breathing. It's not what you do, it's just what happens. You don't do anything. The only thing you can do in meditation is mess it up. That is one of the reasons why, one of the other similes, which I got from Air Asia. When I was traveling on Air Asia, just getting bored sitting on the seat, actually I just wanted to recline the seat, but this is no joke, the person sitting right behind me was this big bikey, huge fellow, and I didn't want to recline my seat because I didn't know what he would do to me from behind. This big fellow, scary, I think coffin cheetahs, I think he had his on his. So anyway, just not the sort of person you should mess around with. So anyway, that I looked at the in-flight magazine. And there they had the description of the aircraft of the future. And they said the aircraft of the future, the biggest cause of problems in aircraft is human error, pilot error. So they said the way to overcome that is to have fully automated aircraft. Just like, you know, driverless cars, to be driverless aircraft. But to keep the passengers with a feeling of security, they'd always have a pilot in the cockpit. And with the pilot would be the second person in the cockpit, which would be a dog. They were the only two people allowed in the cockpit, or beings, the captain and a dog. And this was written by a captain, you know, in Air Asia, who was predicting the future of aircraft. And the job of the captain, or the pilot, whatever you might call it, the job of the person in the front of the aircraft only had one job to do, and that was to feed the dog. And the job of the dog would be to bite the pilot if he touched anything. And that was the aircraft of the future. A pilot and his dog. Pilot feed the dog, if he touched any of the controls. And I thought that would be a wonderful simile for deep meditation. If somehow or other I can get a dog inside your mind, brain, and any time he's trying to do something, bite you. What do I do next? Bite you. And I should be doing that, bite you. I should be on my effort, bite you. I can do no, bite. So you can really let go. So that's what happens in the meditation. You're sitting there just being kind, just being in this moment, and you go into, the breath comes up. When the breath comes up in this method, you find the breath is so peaceful, so easy, so joyful. because it's coming up at the right time. You're not forcing it. It's not like a premature birth. It comes out when it's ready to come out. It's not like shaking a fruit off a tree when it's not ripe yet. When it's just naturally ripe, it falls off and it's the sweetest. So this is where the breath just comes, and it's gorgeous because it's a natural breath, not forced, because everything else has disappeared. You're opening up in the lotus, that's only thing left there to watch for now, the breath. And so you get to this stage in the lotus, opened up, just mindfulness and kindness, that's all. Warmth and light of the sun, just watching this breath go in, breath go out. You're not trying to control the breath or make it go long or short or in between or whatever which way. It just comes in and goes out by itself, naturally, as it's always done ever since you were born. And you're just looking at it with your mind. And because you're not doing very much, the awareness and mindfulness is increasing. Because the mindfulness is increasing, whatever you see looks more joyful. The deeper you go into the lotus, the more beautiful the petals are. And you're just watching this delightful breath, beginning to end. Not missing a moment of it. The full awareness of the breath, from beginning to end. And from the out-breath, beginning to the end. So peaceful, doing something so simple. It's even more refined than watching the trees grow. Just watching the breath come in, go out. Simplest of meditation objects. And of course, it's not only boring when you want something else. You know, the FOMO, fear of missing out. You're not missing out. Well, actually, you are missing out a lot. You're missing out of greed, hatred, delusion, suffering, boredom, anxiety, depression, attachments. You're missing out so much. I don't like this idea of FOMO, fear of missing out, amongst our young people. I prefer JOMO, the joy of missing out. I missed out so much of life. Oh, wonderful. So, we're just there meditating and we have this breath, a delightful breath. And that's where just as you go into the delightful breath, the delight gets stronger and stronger. In fact, the delight is more strong than the breath. So you start to be aware of the piti sukha, the joy. It's not something you do. These are just landmarks on the journey. Just sitting here, oh, this is so joyful. Having a wonderful time, just deep inside the mind. And of course, soon that lotus opens up, that petals of lotus, the delightful, joyful breath opens up. And inside, that's where you see these nimittas, these beautiful lights. All it is your breath has subsided. The mind has just increased in its power. And this is how people see the mind, mostly. Like it's a beautiful light. It's how people experience their mind when the five senses shut up for good. When you die, you go towards the light. So here, you're not dead, but the five senses of which has been calmed down so that you can see that beautiful mind. And that's where, what do you do next? I think just mindfulness and kindness onto your nimitta. This is where people keep stuffing up. You get the beautiful nimitta, and then the pilot tries to touch something and spoils it all. Unfortunately, they haven't got the dog inside your mind yet to stop you touching things. So you got the beautiful nimitta, say, yes, yes, nimitta, and then it all falls apart. Oh, I'm afraid, oh, this is a bit strong for me. Whoa, so my first meditation retreat. Oh, I don't want to become a monk, I don't want to become a nun, there's too many other things I want to do in life. But like this young Anagarika years ago, and he says, oh, so, you know, about time you ordain. He said, no, I don't want to ordain yet. Give me another year. I said, why? You know, you're a good person. No, because I want to see the final episode of Harry Potter, and then I'll ordain. He said that. He was a Harry Potter fan. He knew if he was a novice, he couldn't go into the movies or see it on the internet or something. So he wanted to, you know, keep his precepts, but see the last episode of Harry Potter, and then he could ordain. But anyway, so sometimes we mess things up by interfering with them. So just leave it alone. You've done fine so far. You got to beautiful nimitta stage. It's wonderful, beautiful. And people say, what should I do? Oh, come on. Just be mindful, be kind. That's all. Treat the nimitta like you treat the breath. Just be aware of it, be kind with it, and just see what happens next. And if you really are mindful and kind, the lights open up. The mind opens up. And even the nimitta sort of opens up. And you go inside it. And there, you're in jhana land. Whoa, that's really cool. And it's amazing how many people pay attention when I mention nimittas and jhanas. People really, you know, it's really good stuff, and fair enough, it is good stuff. And this is how you experience those things. You open up the lotus, and deep inside, you find this is what happens to everybody. So inside you, these beautiful nimittas, and inside them is the jhanas. Inside the first jhana, you find the second jhana, and the third, and the fourth, one after the other. Until you go to the what's called the immaterial states. Deeper and deeper inside, and inside, and inside. Until you get to the last layer of petals. When that opens up, what's right in the middle? What's right in the heart of the lotus? Do you want to know? A teddy bear. No, it's not a teddy bear. The jewel in the heart of lotus. That's me. No, that is, of course, hard to comprehend. But right in the heart of the lotus is nothing. Nothing. Gone. Cessation. All finished. Do you believe me? No, you don't. You can't, because this is what we have to experience. But all the whole way, it's just such a gorgeous path. Path of happiness, bliss upon bliss upon bliss. And that's what happened in the time of the Buddha. The Buddha gave this wonderful little anecdote, like a picture of life in a monastery in the time of the Buddha. This is the Dhamma Chaitya Sutta, Majjhima Nikaya, where the Buddha, it was a king. Well, King Prasenadi went to see the Buddha in Sarvati, in the Jeta Grove monastery. And it was obviously walking distance. So the king, after work, went to see the Buddha. And he went inside the Buddha's, knocked on the door, and the Buddha invited him in. And the king started saying how much he appreciated, you know, having a teacher like the Buddha right next door. And how, you know, he loved the Buddha. Remember, as a king, as a monarch, you don't have anyone else you can really take advice from. And he had the Buddha as his teacher. And the king said how much he enjoyed coming to the monastery, the Jetavana. And that's where the Buddha asked him, why? Why do you like coming to the monastery? And that, at this monastery, that's where the Buddha replied, the king replied, because in this monastery, all the monks, the nuns are always happy and smiling. And the Buddha said, yes, that's what you can expect when people are practicing properly. And that, when I saw that, whoa, that's a powerful little photograph of life in the time of the Buddha. When people are practicing properly, you're getting somewhere in your meditation, your insight, you have a smile on your face. When suffering starts to disappear and happiness takes its place, you can't hide that. So, what's one of those other little tricks? When someone comes up to me and they said, They've just had another jhana. And I look at them. And the meter, which I often use to check whether they are faking it or whether it's real, is the mouth. If the mouth is horizontal, sorry. That wasn't a jhana. If the corners are down, nope. If they're up a little bit, maybe. If they're almost spinning your face up wide, yes, well done. The emotional, whoa, that was, whoa. probably. So these are high emotional happy states. And later on, we'll talk about why. And why they don't lead to attachment. And why they are so pregnant with insights and understanding about the human condition. But that is the subject of a talk for another day. In another Dhamma hall close to you. I.e. tomorrow. So, here we go. Sadhu. Sadhu. Come to me. Sadhu. Very good, okay. So there's many teddy bears available. So if you want to borrow one before one goes, you can borrow mine as well. Because we share each other out. Sometimes it gets bored with me. You're not attached to me? No, 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 no. Want someone else? Yes, yes, yes. Okay, so we also have our interviews now.